Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The August jobs report showed unemployment is refusing to budge. President Obama came under attack for the timing of his upcoming jobs address rather than its content. Rick Perry continued to outperform his rivals in the GOP presidential race, and the Northeast is still picking up the pieces after Hurricane Irene. Joining me for this week's top domestic stories on the Friday News Roundup, Michael Shearer of Time Magazine, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg, and David Wilna of NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Boy, these job numbers look pretty bad, Michael Shearer.
And maybe the most surprising thing is that they're not that surprising. I mean, no one really has much optimism right now. The president put out a mid-year review with economic projections yesterday that showed a scenario where we would still have 9% unemployment through next year. And more, you know, even the optimistic scenarios right now have us on election day with unemployment well above 8%. So there's not much short-term hope.
So on Thursday, the OMB released a mid-session review, Gene, saying that they're predicting unemployment won't fall below 6% until 2017.
Yes, the recoveries from recessions for the last couple of decades have been getting slower and slower and slower, and this is snail pace. Economists still don't think we're going into a second recession, a double dip, if you will. But there are reports around the country where communities feel as though that has actually happened to them, where they have unemployment in some areas of Georgia at 20%. The president is going to be going up into Michigan. Detroit is in 14-15%. So there are pockets in the country where they just feel like it's laughable to say that a recovery ever began because it's been so slow, no one can detect it.
So, David Wilna, the president is going to speak to a joint session of Congress next Thursday. Talk about the timing on that speech.
Well, I first learned of the president's intention to address a joint session of Congress just before noon on, I guess it was Tuesday, and this was a tweet from Dan Pfeiffer from the White House saying that the president was going to do this. Then they released a letter saying that he had respectfully requested 8 o'clock p.m. Wednesday evening for the time to do that of Speaker John Boehner and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. We all right away thought, I was at the Senate radio TV gallery, that's exactly when the GOP presidential hopefuls are supposed to be debating at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. And, you know, whether this was an oversight, whether this was intentional, not clear, but it seemed like there was right there the potential for a big flare-up. And indeed, that's what exactly happened.
It was shocking.
Well, right. And you know, the White House contends that Chief of Staff Bill Daley spoke with Speaker Boehner on that morning and that the Speaker did not raise any objections at the time to the time and date for that joint session. But subsequently, Boehner put out a letter saying that, in fact, this wouldn't work on Wednesday evening and that he requested that instead the president speak on Thursday evening. Now, the White House backed down on this about 9:15 that Tuesday evening. It was Wednesday evening. Yes, Wednesday evening. And I was looking at my email. I saw an email from Republican Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina at 8:24 on Wednesday evening, saying that if there were a request for the president to address a joint session on Wednesday evening, he would object. And if a senator objects to this, and there has to be the concurrence of both chambers to have a joint session, then you would get into a whole filibuster thing, and it wouldn't happen anyhow. Whoa. And it was about 50 minutes later when the White House folded on this one. But in a sense, this was almost predictable that this would happen, and it left the president looking both rebuffed and possibly even disrespected by Republicans.
But doesn't it also leave the White House staff up in the air in the eyes of the public? Did they know what they were doing? Did they not know that this debate was scheduled? It just doesn't make sense, Jane.
Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense. This is very much a self-inflicted wound by the White House. I mean, Speaker Boehner acknowledges the phone call took place with the chief of staff daily, but says he didn't raise objections, but he didn't agree either, and that the White House then took it upon itself to go ahead and announce it before an agreement had truly been reached. The White House clearly knew there was a debate scheduled for that night. They knew exactly what they were doing. Jay Carney was in the briefing room later, and he defended the decision and said, move the debate. It's just a coincidence. So they knew it, they knew that they had conflicted with that Republican event. And so let's start with tweeting the announcement. One of the most important speeches he's going to give in the run-up to his reelection. This could be an opportunity for him to try to begin to reset the conversation, to rehabilitate his image. And it starts with a tweet. I mean, all around, it was odd.
The important thing to look at here is the context. In the month of August, President Obama's poll ratings on whether the American people see him as a strong leader or as someone who can get things done fell about 10 points, a huge drop. And that was because of the debt limit debate. The White House has been talking for weeks about how they're going to come back in September, and there's going to be a significant pivot in which the president is going to put forward a positive plan to create jobs. And if Republicans resist that plan, he's going to go after them. He's going to go on offense, which is something he didn't do much over the summer because of the debt limit debate. So that's their agenda. They come back, and instead of going on offense, they show once again that they're willing and able to be pushed around by Republicans. And there's two problems here. One is the American public, this perception that Obama's not the strong leader, the weak leader, is going to really impact him. I don't think as much among Democrats who will rally to him next year, but among independents who want someone fighting for them right now, someone who is willing to sort of stick up for them as they are fearful about the economy. And second, inside Washington, there's a perception that Republicans are still emboldened. And the coming months, no matter what the president puts in his speech next week, are really going to be a battle between two different visions of how to get the economy going again. And the president's going to really have to be able to assert himself. And he's already sort of, stabbed himself in the leg.
Michael Scherer, White House correspondent for Time magazine. The first comments from the White House on the jobs report: economic advisor Catherine Abraham says 9.1 unemployment is a level that remains unacceptably high, but says it's important not to read too much into any one monthly report. She says the report underscores President Obama's call for Congress to quickly pass a transportation highway bill. How likely do you think that will happen, David Wellner?
Well, this surface transportation bill expires September 30th. It's the seventh extension of this bill. Since the House and the Senate can't agree on competing versions of a longer-term reauthorization of this. And so President Obama wants a clean extension, a kind of a stopgap extension of this bill to keep the highway and railroad projects going that are in the works right now. There is a commitment on the part of John Mica, the Republican chairman of the House Transportation Committee, to go along with a short-term extension. It's not clear for how long. He said he would agree to one of them. So I think that is not going to be such a big fight. I think the bigger fight is going to be over the Federal Aviation Authorization, which lapsed at the end of July,
right.
when members of the Congress went home without extending it. We had some of the FAA workers furloughed. They weren't collecting the fees, and there was a hue and cry about this. They worked out a short-term deal that runs out September 16th. But the underlying conflict that has kept them from getting a long-term reauthorization, I can't see getting resolved anytime soon.
Michael, what do you expect in President Obama's speech?
I think there's only the menu of options he has to re-stimulate the economy is not that big. There are not a lot of rabbits he can pull out of his hat. So we don't know the specifics of how he's going to do it, but the categories are pretty clear. He's going to push for a continuation of the payroll tax cut, which was given at the end of last year. Average families getting about $1,000 into their paychecks. They don't notice it happening, but it's money in the economy. He wants that to continue through the end of next year, at least. It's possible he pushes for an employer-side tax cut, which would add an incentive for people to hire, for small businesses to hire more workers. There's going to be infrastructure spending, possibly on schools, and probably something to deal with the housing market.
Michael Scherer, White House correspondent for Time Magazine. We'll take a short break and be right back. And welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with David Wellner of NPR, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, Michael Scherer of Time Magazine. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Gene Cummings, on that last bit about speaking before the Congress to present his outline for a jobs plan. Why did President Obama simply not choose to speak from the White House?
Well, my thinking, what you hear from them is that they want to send the big message. I mean, a speech before a joint session of Congress is pretty serious. It generally gets picked up by the networks and is treated as a serious event. It's a signal to the public that he considers this an issue of such importance. And it then also puts the Republicans in the chamber as his audience, and so he can directly challenge them to take this agenda and run with it or not.
And we've already heard from one Republican who says even though it's going to be on Thursday, he plans to stay at home.
Well, that may not be that big a deal. Often at these joint addresses, even State of the Unions, a number of people don't come. They don't. You don't notice they're not there. But there's no doubt that this fall is going to be ugly. The idea that President Obama can go and give a joint address and challenge them and then they'll suddenly see the light. I mean, Speaker Boehner is giving a speech today in which he says, proposals for further stimulus spending are hurting jobs and holding back the economy. That's what they're talking about. The two sides here are not even agreeing on the basic economic physics at
what
work.
What is John Huntsman talking about in his GOP plan?
John Huntsman went this week. Mitt Romney's going to go next week. All the candidates are coming out with their jobs plans. Huntsman's plan doesn't really include too much that specifically addresses jobs. He's in favor of a big tax reform effort, including lowering rates for everybody in a revenue neutral way. He would get rid of all deductions. All deductions, just wipe them out.
Mortgage.
That's right.
Child care, everything you can imagine.
A very bold plan that will never pass Congress because the American people are, used to these deductions. It's going to take a long time to convince them that it's a good thing to phase this out. Huntsman's problem right now is that he came into the race saying, I'm going to be the rational, quiet speaker, and the economy has gone downhill since then. Nobody wants someone to speak quietly and reasonably right now, and he's trying to find a new message, and it's not clear where that message is. What's interesting about that speech is that the things he's put forward are very similar to the things other Republicans have put forward, the things the House GOP has put forward, maybe a little more bold in that direction, but it doesn't really distinguish him in any way from the pack, and that's really what he needs to do right now.
Basically, in exchange for eliminating all of those deductions, he would have three flat rates, just 8%, 14%, and 23%. So everyone's rates, and he would eliminate the capital gains taxes altogether, which even Warren Buffett says is a nonsensical thing to do because it would only increase the gap between the wealthy and the not wealthy. So it is, in a sense, the ideas Republicans have talked about, 2.0. But even the Bowles-Simpson Debt Commission, who toyed with these ideas as well, noted that there would be negotiations, that getting rid of the mortgage tax deduction is not within reach right now, given the way the public has become quite dependent upon it. And so has the housing industry, which is critical to our recovery as well.
David.
Well, you look at these proposals coming from the Republican presidential contenders, and they're really kind of recycling the perennials of GOP economic policy. Cut taxes, cut regulations. There's going to be a big mm-hmm. push in the House this fall to go after especially environmental regulations, the EPA.
And before we get to that, I want to take a look at the recent surveys of who's on top in the Republican lineup. It would seem that Rick Perry has taken a big leap, Michael.
Yeah, he's leading most of the national polls right now. It's early, so it's not clear if this is a bump. It's also not clear whether this translates into those early states as cleanly as he wants. But I think another month of this polling, people are going to stop talking about, or they've already stopped talking about Mitt Romney as the front runner. And it becomes a real tight race between those two people. Mitt Romney's message from the beginning of this cycle has been, I am the one who can take on President Obama the best. I am the electable one. In the Republican Party don't necessarily, they're not really attracted to him, but they're attracted to that message. Now here comes Rick Perry. He's got, in many ways, better conservative credentials. He comes from the traditional religious base of the Republican Party. And if he can make the electability argument, Mitt Romney's in big trouble.
I think Perry does have several tests ahead of him. It's very clear that he can energize the base. Can he get beyond the base? We don't know. He's out raising money as fast as he can. He's well known in Texas as a brilliant fundraiser, but in Texas there are unlimited donations. And so I did a little math, and if you take all the people who've donated to him in Texas, where they've donated close to $200 million, a lot of money, he's been in office, by the way, for a long time, so that's his lifetime donations. But you put them all together, and they could raise about $1 million bucks if you put them underneath the limitations and the cap of the federal donation of maximum of $2,600. So he's got to build a national operation. He's got Haley Barbour's nephew behind him now, the Mississippi governor. That's a powerful machine if he can bring that machine on. So he's got that to prove, because Romney is a proven fundraiser. And I think, we haven't mentioned her yet, but Michelle Bachmann lies out there as the surprise in the wings. Winning the straw poll gave her a bump in Iowa. And Michelle Bachmann is also a prolific fundraiser. And so I think when we get to the end of this month, their next round of reports come out, we're going to see that those three are really dominating in that way as well, making them all very viable
David,
for the future.
Now, there's a problem, too, with Bachmann and Perry, because they're both going after the Tea Party base, competing for the same voters. Perry is a divisive figure in the Republican Party. The George W. Bush team does not like him at all and has not been saying good things about him. Moderates in the Republican Party are not attracted to him. And there's a real question about what would independents think. And this is going to be a presidential race battling for the votes of independents. And I think that's the electability question is going to loom really large in this.
I want to ask you all about Hurricane Irene and the aftermath. We had many people who lost their lives in this, but it, in the political sense, it has become a big deal, with some on the Republican side calling for the dissolution of FEMA. A curious time to do it, Michael.
Yeah, and I think they'll probably be backing away from that. I mean, FEMA is an incredibly important and popular program. I mean, what the Republicans are calling for is not necessarily getting rid of the federal money, but devolving control of the money back to the states. In practice, you probably want more coordination, not less. I think what Irene showed is that when Obama and his government is able to actually do stuff by itself, which includes a lot of the foreign policy successes he's had recently, he actually performs very well. It's when he needs partners in Congress to do stuff that he really struggles.
Interesting that you had Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey taking on these folks.
Well, Governor Christie has got some issues of his own at home, political issues. He was away during the big storms in the winter and took a lot of criticism for that. So he, you know, was looking to improve his image and by handling this one better. And, you know, there was a lot of criticism initially after the storm of the federal government and the media for overhyping the storm because it didn't hit New York City and some other big locations in the way people thought it might.
But look at what it did to Vermont.
Right. As it turned out, it was a very significant storm, and FEMA was ready. And they had to move their things pretty quickly, but they at least were out there moving around. Now, New Jersey got hit really hard in ways that, you know, they were expecting the shoreline. It went inside. The damage is done in different ways than people thought. Christie, you know, comes under some criticism for not being prepared for that. But, you know, these storms are unpredictable.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I think he's more just trying to lay the blame elsewhere.
And another one on the way, David Wilton.
House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's district was hit by Irene. It was also hit by the recent earthquake. And yet he's going out saying relief money should be released unless we find other money to cut to compensate for that. And in many ways, I think this is an argument that we've been hearing since really President Obama was inaugurated. He inherited pretty much an economic disaster, and the fight was over the role of the federal government in trying to do something about that. The stimulus package that he was pushing was dismissed by Republicans as wasted money. And I think that in many ways this parallels that argument. Republicans are saying that the role of the federal government in this should be curtailed. And if anything is done, it should be paid for, going against decades of tradition of there being exceptions made for disasters.
And what Governor Christie is saying is, I hope we're not going to have the same kind of argument, prolonged argument, with cutting dollar for dollar that we spend on FEMA. you know, when people are so in need. You know,
really what this is about is the Republican candidates and members of Congress playing to this Tea Party idea that it's spending that's the problem. We have to control spending. If you look at the records of Governor Romney when he was governor of Massachusetts or Governor Perry in Texas, they have both been very aggressive at going after FEMA funds when they have disasters in their state, of boasting, you know, in press releases when they get the FEMA funds for those disasters, of pushing for appropriations from the Appropriation Committee to help their states after disasters. And none of that money was ever paid for. I mean, that all that money was added to the deficit. They don't really have much credibility when it comes to this. And I don't expect that if either one of them became president, they would actually follow through with it. They're just trying to look intellectually consistent with their rhetoric, which is that spending's the real issue here, and we have to cut it, and we can't keep
and
spending.
Tell me, Michael, why President Obama chose Alan Krueger to replace Austin Goolsbee?
I think it's someone he knows. It's a labor economist who has worked with not just other people in the White House, but the issues of jobs and job creation. I don't think it really signals anything big in any direction of a new tack that the president is taking. I mean, this is someone who worked in the Treasury Department for the first couple years of the Obama administration, knows the team. He's very well respected as an academic. And he's probably someone who, you know, can talk to Republicans, which is something they want. But it's not the kind of choice that says, now we're going in this direction.
Michael Scherer, White House correspondent for Time magazine, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Haverhill, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Diane. President Obama is a Johnny come lately on the jobs picture. He should have been having this speech a year or so ago. He didn't listen to the progressives at all. In the Progressive Caucus, they've had a jobs bill for 6 months or so that he hasn't even looked at. He didn't listen to Paul Krugman, who wanted a huge double what the bill that he passed, the stimulus bill. Bob Herbert was another columnist all during 2009 and 2010. Every other column was just about jobs. So he's kind of throwing the progressive wing of the country and the party under the bus. We didn't vote for a cautious, pragmatic president. I thought I was voting for a progressive, Diane.
David, well, no.
President Obama, of course, has one big problem, which is the U.S. Senate. And he did not have the votes to pass a bigger stimulus package. In fact, it had to be whittled down to get the final votes needed to push it past the 60-vote threshold that a filibuster would keep it from moving forward with. And I think that there is an argument to be made that maybe if the president had started out asking for a much bigger package, that if they then had to bargain it down, they would have ended up with something more than what they ended up with. But having covered the Senate, I know how extremely difficult it is to get them to agree to something like this.
There is a political criticism of Obama that is pretty widespread now in town among Democrats, that after the midterm elections in 2010, Obama and his team took as the lesson that they wanted to now play on the Republican turf. They wanted to now work on deficits. They wanted to show that a Democratic president could cut, was responsible here, and they weren't going to fight the tide. They also expected at that point that the economy would be doing much better than it is now. So now they have to once again pivot back to more spending, more tax cuts to stimulate the economy. And now they're going to fight against that tide. And it is a problem for them after another 10 months where the jobs they talked about but they weren't really acting on, they have to now pivot again.
All right, to Chesapeake, Virginia. Good morning, Jay.
Thank you, Diane. I have a question. There has been a natural disaster that has been going on for some time in the state of Texas and Oklahoma, and that is the catastrophic drought conditions. A couple comments about that. The first one is nobody has suggested that Governor Perry not run for president and that he should stay home and somehow wave a magic wand and fix the drought. Nobody has said anything about that. The second one, tying in with your show yesterday about FEMA and how some of these Republicans want to defund it or whatever. How is Governor Perry handling this drought? What is the state of the economy in Texas? I have heard that some municipalities are on the verge of running out of water. There's no crops growing. Cattlemen are having to slaughter their animals. So I'll just hang up and listen to the radio for the response.
All right. Thanks for calling. Gene Cummings.
Well, certainly the drought is a horror. There's no doubt about that. Perry, if he were running for governor again, might be in trouble in Texas, but he's not. He's serving his second term. He's safe politically, so he can probably has the political freedom to go and make a run for the presidency, not being overly concerned about fallout back at home. As for his administration, the Texas has had growth. It has had job growth. There is debate about how good those jobs are. There's a sense that many of those jobs are service jobs that don't pay very well, but he does have a record of job growth in Texas.
Gene Cummings at Bloomberg News. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. International news changes too rapidly to wait for the Sunday talk shows. Get insight and analysis from top journalists on the week's most important stories. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. During the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Gene Cummings, David Wilton, and Michael Shearer, here's a tweet from Kevin in Michigan. Which Republican members of Congress said they won't show such disrespectful behavior should be noted? I'm making a call. David Wilton.
Well, it was Joe Walsh, who is a freshman Republican from Illinois, Tea Party-backed, kind of a rabble-rouser in his own right. He voted against the debt ceiling package that his leader had endorsed. And he said that the House is actually going to be meeting starting Wednesday evening. He's going to turn around and fly back to Illinois on Thursday evening rather than attend the joint session. Now, it's not unprecedented for members not to attend a joint session. Some of them hardly ever do. Ron Paul, one of them. But to make a big show of it and announce it to everybody, that's something else.
Here's a comment from Phil on Facebook. He says President Obama may offer tangible ideas in his job speech, but his biggest problem has been an amorphous presidency, something akin to a ship without a rudder. Its propellers are turning, but the craft is moving in whatever direction the wind seemed to push him, which ends up being nowhere. Michael Scheer.
I agree that that is one of Obama's biggest problems right now. He has to be able to make the case in a re-election next year that he is the guy to move the country forward. And to the extent that people don't see him as either a strong leader or someone who has a clear vision for doing that, for pushing the country forward, he's going to have a much harder time making that sale.
Jean. And certainly the public opinion polls in the last month have begun to document not just the decline of Congress, which has got an approval rating of about 12%, which I think ranks them somewhere near us journalists, but the president is now around the low 40s. But the leadership number had held up for him for a while, and that has dropped, I think, about 10 points. And Michael's right. That's a really important number when you're running for re-election. And that sense of drifting is very prevalent among Democrats in particular. And they've been disappointed by his performance, and they do feel like he's been pushed around by the Republicans. So there again, you know, you just start layer upon layer, it all goes to leadership. And that, I think, is why the self-inflicted wound over the speech this week just sticks and adds another ding that they certainly didn't need to bring on.
All right, to Plymouth, Massachusetts, Rod.
Hi, Dan, and hi, Mr. Scheer. I read your Time article on how the Obama team is looking to history for some guidance here, and I could see that they are somewhat optimistic after learning some lessons from the 1936 election with FDR. I teach AP U.S. history, and we cover that period pretty closely, and I think they're missing a really important point. FDR had to deal with a very aggressive opposition from the right, just like Obama. But FDR had the hearts and minds of the American people on his side, and that seemed to immunize him from, you know, these vicious attacks. And Obama, not all his fault, but for a variety of reasons, he just doesn't enjoy that same support. And that's why I don't think that this jobs proposal is going to get much traction at all either.
Just to recap for the other listeners, I have a story this week in Time magazine about a unannounced retreat that Chief of Staff Bill Daley had at Fort McNair in June, in which he invited the historian Michael Beschloss to come in and talk about how presidents in the past have won re-election with unacceptably high levels of unemployment. And Beschloss's message was, there are two presidents who have pulled this off in the last century, FDR in 1936, Ronald Reagan in 1984, and that both followed very similar strategies. They argued convincingly enough that the economy, though bad, was improving, and they argued that their Republican opponents would actually make things worse. You're absolutely right that there are enormous differences between what Obama faces now, what FDR faced, and what Reagan faced. One of the biggest ones is that both Reagan and FDR had economies that, even though they were bad, were actually improving at far quicker rates than Obama's going to have. And the White House's lesson is not to say, oh, we can just do what FDR did. It's a little more distant. It's that those are our two priorities. We have to figure out a way to make the case by the next spring that the economy is not stuck in neutral, and we have to define our Republican opponents as people who aren't going to move forward. But you're absolutely right. I didn't mean to suggest in that article the White House is just saying we are just like FDR.
And the listeners can actually read Michael Scheer's Time magazine story on our website. Go to drshow.org. Let's go to Denise in San Francisco, California. Good morning.
Good morning. What I'm hearing is really distressing to me because it's not just your show. I mean, this 10-minute focus on some obvious staffing one-upmanship with the scheduling of the speech isn't important. But during the debt ceiling debate, I didn't hear the focus on what the Republicans were obviously doing as a political maneuver. When you've got Mitch McConnell in January saying that his only priority is to make sure that Barack Obama is a one-term president, you've got to look at this debt ceiling debate in a different light. You know, there is politics going on of a Machiavellian nature. And if the idea that the Democrats can't stand up and fight, somebody on Obama's team has to realize that Donna Brazile can't be a part of the mix. you know, look how she screwed up the Gore campaign. This is serious stuff. We can't lose to the Republicans because they want a Mad Max free economy, free market economy, where there's no regulation.
David.
Yes, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell actually made that remark right after the election in November. And it's really colored everything that's happened since. You can look at virtually everything that happens on the Hill through the prism of him saying that his top priority is to make sure that President Obama is a one-term president. And, you know, I think that the fact that the White House did sort of buy into the argument that there is a deficit crisis right now is one that has sort of left them checkmated in a way in this argument with Republicans, because, in fact, there was no deficit crisis because borrowing was very easy. Interest rates are extremely low. I've been in countries where there definitely was a debt crisis and they couldn't borrow any money. But that is not the case in the United States right now. And I think that instead of making the argument that we have not gotten out of a recovery, we haven't had a recovery that's adequate enough and that requires further government stimulus, Democrats sort of bought into this anxiety about the debt looming larger and larger.
So you're saying that Republicans succeeded in making the case for an artificial debt crisis.
They really set the narrative that we are broke when, in fact, right now, this is the best time the government has actually had to borrow money and to do something about getting people back to work, which is the real crisis that most people think is out there.
Gee.
I agree definitely with what David said, that one of the frustrations in the public's eye is that they're worried about jobs and they're not worried about the deficit right now, except for the one that's in their own bank account. So, but in regards to McConnell, that he has to be viewed in a more complex way, because McConnell was indeed the person who probably played one of the most pivotal roles in resolving the debt crisis stalemate that we had in Congress in April. And if he wanted to tank the presidency, that might have been an opportunity to do so. And so he is a shrewd player, no doubt about that. And there are politics, as the caller said, going on all sides. Both sides are playing plenty of it. But the risk, I think, to the president in the way that they have built up this speech for next week is, I think it's written, baked in the cake, that the Republicans are not going to agree to do half of what he says up there.
Or perhaps anything.
Any of it. That's right. And even the White House seems to be coming in with that assumption. And the real issue here is that our economy just has to recover on its own. And he just doesn't, there isn't a whole lot he can do or that the government can do to try to speed this up. The consumer confidence has to come back. Consumers have to get back out and buying. And until that really starts to happen, creating demand for businesses, then we're not going to see the recovery pick up and start moving at a more rapid pace. And the president can't make people go shop.
To Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Melissa.
Yes, good morning. Corporations are sitting on $2.5 trillion profits, yet they say they're afraid of investing in jobs unless they and the Republicans are assured that they will pay less taxes and make more profits. But the poor and the middle class, they have a justified fear of spending, and their fears are the choices they must make on what they have to spend on, whether it's food, gas, rent, or medicine. Also, I'm not surprised the Republicans are opposed to the president's job program. I truly believe that the Republicans are encouraging many corporations to hold back jobs so it might weaken President Obama's reelection.
Michael.
I think corporations and lobbyists have been making that argument that we need more incentives and then we'll invest. They're actually trying to get billions of dollars brought from overseas profits to the U.S. at a tax discount, saying they're going to invest that money. I think you're absolutely right to be very skeptical of those arguments. The reason corporations are holding on to this cash is because they don't feel there's enough demand to spend it. And if there's not a demand, if the marketplace is not demanding more widgets or more services, they're not going to go out and build more factories to build those widgets.
It's a catch-22.
It's a cycle. We are caught in this cycle where the consumers are afraid. They won't go out and buy. That that makes demand fall off, and then businesses won't invest until there's demand.
But I don't agree that there's nothing the government can do. I mean, for example, with infrastructure projects, they can streamline things. And in fact,
yes.
I think President Obama is going to say that he's going to instruct agencies to approve projects much faster. Something such as unemployment insurance, which is going to expire at the end of the year. Economists know that the money that goes to people for unemployment insurance is spent immediately. It has a much more of a multiplier effect than tax breaks.
But how much cooperation does he have to have from Congress to speed those things?
Well, he can actually, that's one of the executive actions that he can take without the consent of Congress to tell his agencies to make these projects move ahead faster. The money is already there for
them. The money is there.
So it would be revenue neutral. But with other things such as extending unemployment insurance, extending this payroll tax break, which also puts money in people's pockets, they go out and spend it. That requires the consent of Congress.
You know, George McGovern was on this program last week, and one of the things he had written in his letter to President Obama in Harper's Magazine was to actually criticize the Congress and to say that lawmakers need to remember that they're there for the nation and to remember that that is their job. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Linda. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Diane. I'm an appraiser in Michigan, and I believe that the housing crisis is what got us into this problem, and I think the housing can get us out of a lot of the economic problems we have. There's a huge stock of houses, most in bad condition, being held by Fannie, Freddie, HUD, and they're being offered up at a steep cash discount at super low prices, which is driving property values. As an appraiser, I know they're driving property values lower and lower. But I think a small tweak in the system requiring that every house being offered, single-family homes being offered for sale, be required to be offered at an improved price, that it be offered at the at a safe and mortgageable condition. HUD standards already exist, so it's not a mystery what that condition would be. It's pretty simple. So rather, so that every house that would be required to be sold would be there. That would allow, at a time of super low interest rates and low property values, everyday Americans to be able to pick up these houses, rather than having just investors jumping in and trying to get them for cash and renting them out and turning us into, like, rental America.
I was asked earlier what will be in the president's speech next week, and I think the biggest mystery is what he's going to do around housing, because there is actually a lot of executive action he could take. He has the ability to try and put pressure on banks to take action here. And there are a lot of very creative proposals for improving the market, one of which the caller just mentioned. I mean, there are parts of the country now where banks are bulldozing houses to improve the market. I mean, they're Fannie and Freddie controls a huge part of this. They can make a lot of tweaks. And I think that'll be the real question I'm looking forward to the answer.
CBS
next
News is reporting that President Obama has ordered a delay and reconsideration of new EPA smog standards, quote, particularly as our economy continues to recover. In the written statement, President Obama cited the importance of reducing regulatory burdens and regulatory uncertainty. You're smiling,
well,
David.
Well, this is actually a preemptive move on the part of President Obama, since Eric Cantor earlier this week sent out a memo to all House Republicans saying we are going to have a week-by-week assault, really, on government regulations. Listed 10 of them, 7 of them were environmentally related. Their contention is that these regulations are inhibiting hiring by the private sector.
But you say it's preemptive, and yet it looks as though the White House is capitulating even before the fight begins.
Again, this is President Obama's disposition, his natural disposition, the place he is most happy with in the world is to feel like he is the bridge builder, taking the conversation to a more rational conclusion. He's a very academic guy in that way. So that's his natural disposition. Then you have David Plouffe, who's his new message guy in the White House, and Bill Daley, who are incredibly focused on convincing independents that he is the guy who is pushing the country to the most rational conclusion. As a result, he is playing on the Republican field. And like we've talked about already on this show, there's a real risk that people don't feel like he's
talking. Very briefly, David.
I think there's a real concern also about the Senate races next year, that there are many Democrats from sort of purple states who are facing tough reelection bids. They don't want to take those tough votes on those environmental issues. And if the White House acts now, maybe they won't have to.
David Wellnev, NPR, Gene Cummings, Bloomberg News, Michael Sherrib, Time Magazine. We didn't even talk about the new lawsuit against the big banks. And that comes next week. Thank you all so much. Have a great and safe Labor Day weekend.
Thank you. Diane.
And thanks for listening all. Back with you on Tuesday after a rebroadcast on Monday. I'm Diane Rehm.